you are not communicating about anything that engages other people, then the value of your communication, even the value of your very presence, risks falling to zero. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, today joined as usual by Pat.
Hey.
Jason.
Hey, welcome.
And William.
Hey, guys.
Today we're looking at Harry Potter and the Order of Chaos. I mean, Jordan Peterson's 12 More Rules for Life. Beyond Order. So, the first question that I have for either of you, the audience, or the people involved, where do you find yourself in the balance of order and chaos? And which of these sets of rules do you think are more valuable for you today?
I'll start.
Let's start with you, William.
That sounds good. Yeah, I think the new set of rules had a much more immediate resonation with me. And I don't know if that's just because I'm familiar with Jordan. And so the first time I got the first set of rules, it was like, who are you? And why are you telling me how to live my life? And this time it's like, oh, I know who you are. Hi, Dad.
Yeah, really.
But I'd like to believe it's because I'm struggling with sort of the disciplined creativity and, you know, really starting to manifest as I am now 27. Happy birthday to me. trying to solidify the things that I'd like to create and get consistent and putting in those sort of micro habits that'll get me on my journey and on my path zigzagging towards my goals now. So this is the stuff that I'm after.
There was a, you know, superficial attraction to the first book. It was a white cover, and this one's a black covered book. And one thing my wife pointed out is that, you know, what is this black, dark book you're reading? And I think what it is, you know, the first book is more geared towards somebody who might already have order in their life. And this one is geared to somebody who might be experiencing chaos and depression. And so they're drawn towards this dark obelisk.
I feel like it might almost be the exact opposite. Like the white one represents pure order and the black one represents chaos. So yeah, wouldn't you be more attracted to, I guess you would be more attracted to the black one if you were engulfed in chaos, but that would just help you use the chaos better, wouldn't it? Wouldn't the person experiencing too much chaos need the white book?
I think that we're dealing with an unhealthy relationship of chaos, right? And so if you're in that depth and it's all you know and it's all you can relate to, you know, you see the black book and you think, hey, that kind of looks like my soul. So you pick it up and you hang out and you get acquainted with the more intricate sort of realities of chaos and how chaotic are you even? And have you even come to terms with the fact that you're not being as creative as you think you are, even though you think you've created this shrine of creativity that is chaos because I'm an artist and art is hard and I must suffer in order to produce something of value and truth. And I'm personally attacking you. I'm sorry, Scott.
Everyone who embraces the starving artist lifestyle just left.
And the toxic perfectionism, right?
I don't think it's wise to actually think of yourself as a starving artist or a perfectionist because Right. Those are just labels and everything.
You're just a label.
Thanks, William. Thank you. I appreciate it. My label? Patman. That's the only label that I have.
Meow.
But, to just go along with that, I did pick up the fact that this book is showing what would happen if you fall into chaos, and even the illustrations in the book show that too. Like in the first rule, we see a picture of a man looking up at the sky and he's with his dog and It looks like he's about to walk off a cliff carelessly. But it seems as though as he's looking up in the sky, you get a sense that he knows that he's walking off a cliff. He just doesn't want to acknowledge it. His mind is elsewhere. So when the first rule says, do not carelessly denigrate social institutions or creative achievement, it does paint a picture to how we never seem to find a right balance in how we are just, you know, denigrating our artistic achievements, you know, our way of laying out what we want to do and not get organized or anything. However, we are drawn to how people communicate with each other as far as, how should I put this? The way they structure their experiences and how they can integrate those into something greater. Like in the instance of, Jordan mentions an example of, you know, Harry Potter and how it was all created.
An example?
An example. So it's very interesting. And in the first part of the chapter, where he mentions loneliness and confusion, I wrote down, people depend on constant communication with others to keep their minds organized, and we need to listen to ourselves so we can organize our thoughts, reactions, motivations, and emotions and concerns. So what do you think about that?
I think it's important. It's funny, I was talking with the person who was training me in my new job this week about how I love notepads, because when I got my job, I was given a notepad. I was like, yes, a notepad. And I'm the type of person who uses a notepad to write my thoughts down, but not to read my notes. So getting a new notepad is great because I can have a new notepad that's dedicated to a topic that I can just write down all of these thoughts that I will probably never revisit. And it does something for me that allows me to, you know, sift through that sort of whatever term you want to call it, the chunks that come out of my mind, and get them in an order that I wouldn't be able to just ruminating internally about. And I think it's even more profound when you actually, you know, engage in someone who has some insight to the topic you're discussing. And that's when you can get interdependence and start spiraling upwards and creating greater and greater things.
That's funny, because I'm the exact opposite. I just keep all my thoughts in my head and never write them down.
Might I suggest something? A Sunday brain dump journal where you just write everything that happened to you in the past week, even if you never look at the brain dump journal again. I was just recommending this to my buddy because he says by Sunday, you know, his brain's getting pretty full, and then he's trying to get back on track because Monday's coming. And it's like, how do you get your brain to stop thinking about everything that it's been thinking about and start focusing on the big rocks of the week? And that's what I said, you know, you just write everything down so that it's been written down and your brain knows that you have heard it think. Because if you don't do a thing, your brain thinks that it hasn't been heard and it'll just start screaming it. And then you do the big rocks. So you say, you know, like on Monday, I have to do this big task. And then on Monday, when you go to do your to-do list, you already know from your journal on Sunday, I have this big task. So what are the pebbles in the sand that happen naturally with the habits and responsibilities of Monday? But make sure that that big rock's in there and sorted first. And maybe it will help. It's worth trying out.
Yeah, I agree with Will there. And it's something that Jordan talks about in this first rule, the necessity to point to things, to write things down. And I think the truly alchemical process happens, though, when you take what you write and say it, especially in the company of another person. You start talking about these meaningful thoughts you have, and you know, who knows where that discussion will lead.
Another thing you just remind me of, one of these things that I do sometimes is when I'm doing my journaling, I journal as if I was going to be having this discussion with maybe my mother or my wife or my grandmother or my child. And it's like, once you imagine a different context, your brain starts doing like happiness or stress or shame, or it really depends what you're journaling about. But when you just are isolated with your pen and your notepad and you don't think about reality and the world and the people that you might share these thoughts with, it's a safer space, but I think it's less vulnerable. And I think you can get away with a lot more when you don't think about sharing your own experience, because we wear hats and we don't put them on until we actually expose ourselves and we realize, wait, I'm being really critical, or I'm not being hard enough on myself. And yeah,
like these hats come off when you're by yourself with a notebook, but every time you're interacting with someone else, you need to have some kind of like identity that's beside who you really think you are. And if you really like start journaling, like, you never know where that's going to end up. You could just be like, I'm gonna write a page about the stuff that I know is on my mind right now, and then 20 minutes later you'll be on page 5 writing a novel. So like, that's been a personal experience for me. I mean, Will's got us doing these gratitude journals, and every time I start, I stop and start working on one of my comic scripts that I'm trying to do. So, you know, I don't know if I'm doing it right, but it seems to be helpful. So
sounds good to me.
So Will has us doing it, or do our higher selves have us doing it?
I think Will appealed to our higher selves. And I now
think I'll give 100% responsibility to both parties.
That makes sense to me. that comes into a little bit about like the beginner mindset, and you have to like kind of approach things as the fool. Like the first image that Jordan Peterson shares is from a tarot card where he's walking off the cliff that Pat described, and there's a lot to really be said about the fool as the precursor to the fully realized being. And so what do you guys think about that?
Well, the Fool is my favorite tarot card. Go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, I like how he pointed out and made clear that the Fool was not some kind of negative characteristic. It was just the beginner. And you have to start out at the beginning level, you know, of any organization and work your way up. I think he was talking about as the fool or as the beginner, you have to make yourself likable by other people around you. And I first read it as, if older people like you, then you're probably doing something right. But he actually said, if other people like you, you're probably on the right path. And I think what happens sometimes with younger people, adolescents, you know, they're sophomores in life, not yet adults, is they're like on a ski lift, metaphorically, up the mountain, and the top of it is adulthood. And, you know, once they get there, they get to have a blast and ride down. But sometimes they want to jump off a bit early and like forge their own path. And I think what he's talking about in this rule is, you know, staying on the lift, working your way up through the beginner to the master, and not trying to shortcut your place in life. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Especially when he talks about that one individual he was having the conversation with about how, you know, her current personal state of affairs was a mess. And then she shifted out of her own self into this whole other monologue that had been installed somewhere about how the world is going terribly and it's immoral for her to have personal desire while things are like this. And it gives her this moral superiority that allows her to stagnate and remain inactive and isolated. And I think that's what happens when we don't talk to other people that have other perspectives. When we're in a vacuum and we're not able to get context. It's like, and it happens to us every week, right? Like, you get to a place where you're like, how can I do anything if everything's going to inevitably die? It's like, well, very simply, just lift your right arm and grab something and proceed to make actions, because like I'm discovering, it's better to do something terribly than it is to do nothing at all.
Yeah, I just want to inject a Marcus Aurelius quote here. Waste no more time debating about what a good man is. Be one. Like, there's no use in just, you know, deciding what's the right way to live. You just got to do it, because we all already know. Like, we're all fools. Every one of us, we're all a beginner at something, so we all have to... Y'all have to refine that aspect of ourselves. It makes
and
me
I think
that.
Of...
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and I think that's where the second rule really comes in to help flesh that out, right? Like the guidance of Mercury. You don't know why you find things interesting, but lean into that and make mistakes and be aware of the fact that you are a fool and you're supposed to make mistakes and be grateful in that and observe the data that you can collect and act upon it in the way that is most efficient to better yourself.
Yeah. And it makes me think a lot about like the genre of punk rock and how all of them are obsessed with the idea of non-conformity. You can't be a conformist. Like, I don't know how many times I've heard that in all of my music growing up. Like, conformity is the enemy. If you conform, you're one of those suits, just you're part of the problem. And we forget what that word actually means. I mean, when Plato's talking about conformity, it's not that different from wisdom in essence. So, like, you have to learn to conform to the group to have wisdom at all, because like, we're not just individuals, we have to interact with other people.
Right, and that was one of the criticisms Jordan had of psychologists like Freud and Jung, where they focus too much on the individual psyche and not so much on the like community health aspect, because this first chapter, I think, is really good for like an introduction to psychology course. He goes over what the self is, you know, trying to identify and define what a self is. And that's not an easy word to define. And he talks about its relationship to the id and the ego and the superego and how those act as governors, if you will, in the same way that the executive and the legislative and the judicial branches act in our own governance.
Yeah, it was pretty heavy as well, right? Like, his vernacular was pretty intense at times, and it was often that I was rereading sentences or paragraphs, because he wasn't just trying to give you advice this time around. I think he was really concrete on what he had to say, and that this was how he felt about it, and that this was the evidence that he'd used to come to those conclusions. And I think it was almost like a one-sided debate, right? Like, he was arguing for the use of the rules and doing his best to illustrate why those rules specifically.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to our conversation about the first Lord of the Rings book, or the first half of the first Lord of the Rings book, when like the hobbits have their set of rules and they keep to it, but no one else has any memory of any such rules. It's like Jordan Peterson finds himself in a situation where like, he's the hobbit, he knows the rules, he keeps the rules, but then he leaves the house, he leaves the Shire, the rules don't exist outside there anymore. So he's trying to, like, it's not just like the 12 rules and then the other 12 rules. It's just the idea of having a sense of order and chaos in the world.
And it's necessary, right? Like it's part of the human experience. Like we crave structure. And if you're anti-structure and you don't understand that it's part of human experience, then you're cursed. But if you do know it, then you're blessed, right? And we're trying to figure that out. All of us, we're reading the Bible and philosophy, and we're trying to find a way to have the ceremony and the ritual and the benefits of religion in a capacity that we can feel genuine and sincere and better about.
And not to mention, like, after reading Nietzsche and then going to Jordan Peterson, like, we started with Jordan Peterson, then read Beyond Good and Evil. Now we're going back to some more Jordan Peterson. I feel like I have a better understanding of both of them going back and forth between the two. Because I feel like Jordan gets so much from Nietzsche. Like, he talks about that tension between the individual and the culture and nature and everything, and Nietzsche was just like, that was his bread and butter. Like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. If you don't have that tension, you can't grow. So I think that's the biggest thing that Nietzsche talks about that Jordan Peterson picks up on.
And that tension you're describing kind of is getting into rule number two about what you could be, your potential self of the future.
But like to get there, you need to integrate the shadow. You can't just coast along in the light. You can't just use order. You need a little bit of chaos. You need the shadow to become your fully realized self. And like I think it really takes, for me anyway, it really took Nietzsche, Jordan Peterson, and like a little bit of Jung here and there to really understand that to the point that I do now.
And John Vervaeke has made some of these things quite clear too in his videos about the meaning crisis. I did want to mention one question that that Jordan focuses on in rule number one is asking what is important. And what's kind of interesting is the etymology of that word literally means, what should we carry? What should we port around? And so you can only carry what's important. Otherwise, you're going to be like a hoarder and have, bags of stuff you don't need. So it kind of made me reflect on life, like what is it that I have that's important, both physically as objects and like qualities as a character in life.
And what conclusions have you come to?
That I'm doing pretty good. I like compared myself to the eight questions he lists on chapter five, like the things that make a person sufficiently embedded in the interpersonal world. And so those questions are real quickly that, have you been educated to the level of your ability and ambition? Do I use my free time for engaging and meaningful and productive things? Have I formulated a solid and well-articulated plan for the future? I would say yes to that. And are they free of any serious physical health and economic problems? Doing all right. Do they have friends and a social life? Yes. A stable and satisfying intimate partnership, married, happily married, a close and functional family relationship. A career, or at least a job that's financially sufficient, stable, and if possible, a source of satisfaction and opportunity. And I do have a career that is challenging. So on that account, I would say I'm doing okay.
Hey, that's pretty good.
Scored better than me, that's for sure.
Well, that's not to say I don't have any problems.
Well, of course not.
But there's a difference between like having problems and having an established goal or aim. Like a goal is only part of the process. Problems come up afterwards, and you have to deal with those ones with new plans and goals and aims.
Well, it's funny, you know, because if you just look at those eight questions and you pretend for a minute that you're an author, right? And it's like, okay, so here's my eight questions, and I want to do a hero's journey. So I need to create a character who fails to meet enough of these things to have a compelling story of him getting to a place where he does succeed to meet all of these criterion. And then it's like, okay, so now we're going to pick a theme. Is it a fantasy? Is he slaying a dragon? Is it a sci-fi thing? Is he saving the planet? Is it just basic modern real world issues? Does he have a loved one who's going through a seriously hard time? And what does he have to do and become to get through that time? And then it's like, so now what's his smart goal? Okay, so now we know where he's going and we know where he is. And because we'd have those two points, we can start reverse engineering the process. And then we can say, okay, how big of a book do I want to write? How many of these steps on this path do I want the audience to be aware of? And how much do I want to flesh it out? How many characters do I need? How many conversations do I need? How many environments do I need to put him in? And what do I need to expose him to so that he can grow and become and redeem and defeat the dragons? And then it's like, just add water.
I think Jordan would agree with that because he's pretty clear in saying, you know, what must be done has to be specified, has to be clear. And we've been working with those SMART goals for you know, our own personal benefits and challenges.
Yeah, once you
Yeah.
start like looking at problems like with the frame of like SMART goals, everything else seems kind of dumb. It's like when you ask the question like what do you want out of life and someone says I just want to be happy, good job, married with kids. It's like that's not a plan. That's not a goal. Be specific. You can't just aim for happiness. First of all, happiness isn't something you can physically aim for. It's a byproduct of meaning. So, you know, there's your first axiom is wrong.
Yeah, like this podcast makes me happy. Is the podcast happy? No. I can't put the happy podcast in my pocket and be and have happy and then give happy to other people. It has to make you happy. You have to determine what makes you happy. And then you say, okay, well, let's have more of that in my life. And it's like, what specifically do you want to do? Why aren't you doing it? Well, I'm not good enough. Well, if I did it, I wouldn't have my moral high seat. Well, if I did that, I'd have to stop carelessly denigrating social institutions and creative
Yeah.
achievement. Oh, I'd have to fail.
In like the same way though, happiness doesn't have a very good meaning anymore. And I would argue in the same way that, you know, our definition of love is three different things, you know, eros, agape, and philia. And like happiness, when we say it invokes all kinds of things in our head. So like, what is happiness? Is it pleasure of any sort? Is it, you know, a sense of meaning? I don't know. That seems kind of vague. Is it like, how do you define it? It's like an amalgamation of too many things, and we have to like separate it. Like the word love doesn't work as well for us anymore because it's like, well, what do you mean? Do you want to eat it or have sex with it?
And that also leads to a question. How
Or
much time do
nurture
you
it.
have to spend thinking about what you want to do? Because for a long
Yeah.
time, you know, I can't think of the number of times where I had to think about what I wanted to do with my life. And it ended up me, you know, once I figured it out and tried it, it didn't last long. And of course, even when I dug through and thought, oh, okay, this sounds interesting. I like to learn more about it. And then once I get into it, even after 5 minutes or so, I'd be like, no, not for me.
Yeah.
Which leads to more investigating, which means to more investigating, which means learning, you know. And of course, I am grateful that, you know, it wasn't the right choice for me and, you know, I know better. But then again, you know, how long do we have to keep searching for what we want to do?
Yeah, it's like you have to find the balance between like picking your goals and researching and actually like meditating and doing the mindfulness work for it. Because like another thing that Jordan talks about, your goals are going to change as soon as you take the first couple steps of your original goals. So you really can't define your goal too much, or then you put yourself in a trap. So you have to like do it in stages, and don't put the cart before the horse. Don't put your final goal, like a completed book, before, you know, a designed lore or world or magical trope or theme or something.
For a publisher.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll discover down the road too, like, if the micro habits that make the end product are something that you hate, you should not do that, right? Like, don't make the goal. For example, I have this really dumb goal that I made for myself a couple years ago that was like, I will have published 3 books. It's like, that's not a goal. That's a wish. Like, you can't smart goal, I will have published 3 books. You can smart goal, I will have published a book, or I will have made progress towards publishing a book or writing a book. And it's like, do you enjoy writing? Because that's what's entailed. And it's like, if writing the book, not for the money, not for the reception, not for the cover, but writing, because the action that you take of communicating your thoughts is rewarding. Otherwise, don't even bother.
Yeah, and the goal of saying, you know, I'm going to be that person that has written 3 books in 3 years, that's not a goal at all. That's like the analogy that I bring up in every single one of our videos these days, someone picking their character from a drop-down list and multiple choice. Like, it, you can't just decide, oh, that guy's a writer, I want to be like that, I'm going to be a writer. Because writing isn't just being that character that's written books. It comes with a lot of work.
And another thing it's been making me think of, there's a whole bunch of different movies and stories that do this, and it's the concept of the genie, and the concept of the deal with Satan, and the concept of, if you got what you wanted at the moment that you wished for it, it would turn out horribly. Because you're not the person that created it, and you don't have the learnings that would come from the path of creating it. And that's why every time you make a wish with a genie, there's a loophole, because it's not about, oh, genies are malicious. It's wishes are malicious. If you don't know where you're heading, and you're not aware of the fact that this thing that you think will bring you happiness could also bring you complete destruction and despair, then you're not prepared to take that journey.
Or in the concepts of time travel stories, where one person decides to change one thing or remove one thing, and then leads to, you know, the exact same thing later on down the road.
Yeah, it's like, you don't know what you're doing. You're screwing it all up.
Or just breaking the entire universe.
Dude, like, the entire, like, Jewish religion wouldn't exist if the promised land was just granted with a wish. It took the 40 years in the desert and the wandering around and the failure of the judges and the failure of the kings and the failure of the integration around everybody else that taught them the lessons to live in the world that we live in now.
Yeah. So today I'm 50% older than I was a third of my lifetime ago.
Dude, I feel like almost twice my age now.
Well, I think you're almost,
like, I'm 28 and I feel like I'm 48.
But if I could have known, you know, 10 years ago that it wasn't about what you were doing or what was happening to you, but it was about how you reacted and all of the lessons I had now, if I could tell my 17-year-old self that, it would be like, dude, just take the journey and fail as much as you darn well can with a grin on. Because if you could get it right the first time, you would screw it up.
Yeah.
Well, I think there also has to be an alternative for when you tell somebody you can't have happiness as your aim. It's not a necessary and sufficient goal. That you should be able to give them something to replace that target with. And I think flow fits into that as a good target. You know, the state of flow on a personal level, if you're doing a specific task, but also Jordan talks about it in this book, you know, being the top dog, the responsibilities of authority, and how there can be a state of flow in an organization between colleagues and peers, and how, you know, that in itself provides a tremendous amount of meaning.
Yeah, I also fear that the flow state might be a bit of a trap, because, I don't know, everyone in the Matrix seemed to be in the flow state. Like, if you, it's like a video game, 24/7 can keep you in the flow state.
Well, I think, and something that I've been talking about a lot in the past few weeks, is that there's flow and then there's dark flow. Mm. And so the metaphor that my trainer for hypnosis used was that we are all floating face down in the river of life. And our goal as a coach is to flip as many bodies so that they can see.
What's and this dark flow? I've never heard of this.
So dark flow is video games, right? Dark flow is anything that gives you the sense of challenge and reward and difficulty and engagement without any benefit to your life and no residual return on fulfillment. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, right? Like, you hit a snowboard jump, you feel cool for a few days. You hit level 80 in World of Warcraft and go to bed. You wake up tomorrow and you went to bed at 3 a.m. and you feel like crap, and your work week is screwed up, and your boss does not care that you got the epic drop on the loot roll. Like, it doesn't matter.
I guess
or
the
same thing
argue
with any other addiction too. That's kind of a dark flow state. And
it's dopamine.
And also the fact that life is not a single player game. It's more of a multiplayer game. And you have to be able to put yourself out there. And I admit, you know, as someone who has hardly played multiplayer games, mostly played single player story driven games, yeah, I could totally get it.
But what are you going to argue, Jason?
I was just going to argue that if you're staying up till 3 a.m. playing a video game, that you may or may not be in a flow state playing, that you're probably out of the good wholesome habits of like sleep hygiene and, you know, going to bed and at a certain time, waking up at a certain time. So I think
I think you're conflating like wholesome and flow state.
Yeah.
I think flow state in and of itself isn't necessarily wholesome and good, but it is like everything. It is the key.
So it's like, when you're in a good flow state, hopefully you have enough awareness to understand that you are still in a body and a vessel that requires nourishment. And I think that with the bad flow of video games, right, like, you get to a point where doing the thing is more rewarding than taking care of yourself. But with good flow, it's like doing the thing is so inspiring that you're going to take care of yourself so that you can continue to maximize your flow state and continue to do that thing that is rewarding. And you know that there is a commitment you have to make to yourself to not be in flow. And you can get in flow getting back into flow, because it's like, I need to eat breakfast if I want to have a good day and not be angry at the world.
But another
thing is, video games, you can skip breakfast and jump right into a raid.
Yeah, but another thing is, you can, I think if you are skilled enough, you can use video games, like, if you're feeling completely unmotivated and then you decide to play Skyrim for half an hour, you know, you kill a dragon, you raid one dungeon, and then you put it down and you say, I'm going to use this momentum to carry me throughout the rest of the day. I'm going to get some writing done, get some reading done. Like, you can measure the usefulness of flow, whether or not it's dark flow or light flow, in the measurement of how much meaning that it supplies for you. Because if you're done and you're left with a product that you can say, I'm proud of that, I created this and I'm happy with that, then you know that you've used flow for the good. But if you come out of flow state and you realize that you haven't showered in 24 hours or even looked up or gone outside or anything like that, then flow has taken over. The dark flow. You've gotten caught up in the flow. You're not using flow. Like, flow is using you.
Exactly. And it's like, so no one's going to deny that video games give dopamine and dopamine feels good. And it's like, if you are at a place where it's like, look, I'm not going to structure my life in any way other than I can wake up and first thing in the morning, I play video games. But if I'm going to do that, because that's the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, I need to have the criteria and the constraints and the boundaries mm-hmm. to recognize that this is a reward system and that I am getting my reward first thing in the morning. And in order to keep doing that the next morning, I have to do this big block after my video game session, and I need to take care of myself and not lie to myself and deceive myself and play for another hour and another hour and another hour. And now it's my whole day is gone, and you lose it. Like it diminishes it. And all of a sudden you're at a dopamine deficit once you're at that point.
Yeah. I think that clarifies what I was kind of questioning, you know, were you lumping video games into like a bad category? But it sounds like you're not, and you know, you just have to have a balance to it. And so would dark flow be kind of akin to like molasses? It's sticky and it holds you there.
Maybe I think more like rapids
or quicksand.
Ooh.
However you want to engage with it, but you want the metaphor to be something that can be of use, right? Like, because with rapids, you can put in an energy dam, right? And you can harness the potential of gravity and water. And if you're not aware of the destructiveness of this force that you're engaging with, you're just going to get your head smashed against a rock and you're going to feel real upset.
It's important to realize that video games aren't the problem. It's your relationship with video games that might manifest as a problem.
And it's like, look, I'm not saying that video games can't be the thing, the mechanism that gives you the return on investment that a lot, like if you are actually going to be a pro gamer that makes generous amounts of money, great. But if you're not, stop lying to yourself. Stop being hard stuck in the bronze elo of League of Legends and giving us all grief because we suck at the game. Like, just move on with your life. You're not going to do it.
Dude, I was watching the LCS yesterday. But like at that point you have to take into consideration the hierarchy. Like you're gonna wake up one day and realize I'm never gonna be a pro gamer. I'm in bronze, you know. I'm not gonna make it to diamond in a week. I'm not gonna make it to challenger in a year. Like, that's just not in the cards for me. I'm 28 years old. I'm past my prime for a video gamer anyway. So like,
but it doesn't mean you can't still enjoy the game, right? Like, and that's the whole thing.
Like, life isn't a game. It's a series of games that you have to play a bunch of games. And some of those games are going to matter a lot more than other games. And some are going to be borderline meaningless, but just allow you to, you know, live in the moment for a little bit. But like, that's another thing that Jordan Peterson talks about in this chapter, where you have to find your equals and your peers in the hierarchy. You don't just, you know, if you're in bronze, you can't play with someone in challenger. You find more people in bronze and silver. That's how you grow. If you just focus on what they're doing in challenger and diamond, you're going to suck for the rest of your life because they're playing a different game.
Literally. Literally.
Yeah. It's like chess. Like, if you learned how to play chess and you've been playing for a week, then you go up against a grandmaster, you're going to last about 3 turns max.
I guess I think the degree to which flow state feels meaningful or significant, it is related to the consequences it has. And so you can get into a flow state in video games, but you can also like lose the match or do, you know, not as good as you thought. And then you might actually have like a dopamine reduction or lack of less serotonin from that. But for me, I think something like riding a motorcycle brings about a very strong sense of flow because of those consequences. And
that Jordan tension. Peterson,
yeah, he talks about this in the second rule, where he's saying that, so the motorcycle, he talks about personifying things, and the motorcycle can be personified. A lot of people will say that their motorcycle is a she, for example. And so it could be thought of as riding the dragon, like you're on the back of the dragon and you're riding over Father Earth, the road. And so they use that in the vernacular quite often, like slab slayers. And so I think this is like one of the reasons why, for me at least, motorcycle riding has that sense of meaning and flow into it, is you have to be constantly in the moment.
Absolutely. Like, and I think, like, don't get me wrong, you'll get hits of adrenaline playing a game of League of Legends, but I think with a motorcycle, literally putting yourself on top of a gas-guzzling people killer, it's like you are powerful, you are in control, you are confident, you must be. And it's like you step onto this thing and you're in this little micro arena where you're the only actor on the show, and it necessitates behaviors, beliefs, and actions. And
and you also kind of like, have to integrate the fool there. You have to integrate the fool, because without that, you're going to be terrified of falling off and smashing your head open. So like you need to embrace a little bit of like no fear. Let's just dive right into it. Let's just leap off the cliff. Let's see what happens. Because nothing comes out of it until you take that leap of faith.
Well, there is the aspect of like wearing a helmet, and how some people, I guess you could either say the people not wearing a helmet are the foolish, or the people who are wearing
the
helmet are
the fool.
Like...
I said embrace the fool, not the idiot.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
Yeah, there's fool and foolhardy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say, like, the fool is still able to, like, put safeguards in place to protect himself. Like, if it's actually lethal, like if you're climbing a mountain, you're going to want a harness. If you're riding a motorcycle, you're going to want a helmet, maybe a jacket.
Well, have you guys seen this movie with Alex Honnold where he climbs Yosemite without a rope?
Yeah.
I think most people would probably fit him into the foolhardy position.
I don't know how I feel about that guy. I watch like a minute of that and my hands start to sweat and I get all shaky. And it's like, oh, I don't like it.
I don't know. I think he's on a different level because he's the master, right? Like, he's not... Fool just doesn't come into the picture with Alex. Like, he's done that run so many times. Like, he can literally do the entire hand and foot positioning in his head physically. Like, he knows where he's going. He's visualizing it. He's running it. He's been to the top. He's been to the middle. He's started from the top and worked his way down. Practiced the jump 50 times, and he's done the alternate routes in case he gets, like, that's a man who is perfecting his craft, and deservedly so. And I think that he couldn't do it any other way. Like, once you get to that place, like, why would you even bother going up that with rope?
And you have to measure, like, flow state is the place between anxiety and boredom. So, I mean, if you keep doing the same rock over, you might get a little bit of boredom integrated into that if you start using a harness, and then you won't be able to do it because you won't be like narrowed into that flow state. I think the biggest thing for Alex Honnold is that he forces himself into the flow state by climbing a mountain and like getting out of that flow state on either end is just death. If you become a little bored, you're going to fall off. If you become a little anxious, you're going to fall off. If you fall off, you're going to get hurt or dead. So.
And the other thing too, like, so to circle back to having a goal, you can't have flow state as a goal because you want to be in flow. Sure. And flow state is amazing for a whole bunch of reasons because nothing else exists in flow. You don't have depression or anxiety when you're in flow state. You do not have the inability to get out of bed when you're in a flow state. You do not have the concerns of everyday life when you're in flow state. It's just not part of the deal. But that's not the goal. The goal is to do the things that make you fulfilled. And while you're doing them, to be in flow state as much as possible. And it's like, we're still not at a goal because it's like, it has to be personal. It has to be completely associated. It's like, what do you actually like doing? Okay. How can we make that integrate to your life?
Yeah. And then to get yourself a little bit closer to that goal, you just follow rule two, you know, imagine who you could be, then aim single-mindedly at that. That's going to get you a little closer to forming a goal. Like, that rule in and of itself isn't a goal either, in the same as flow state or happiness, but you have to use all of these tools to find your goal. Like, you don't just, you know, kick over a rock and then realize, oh, that's what I've always wanted out of life, I get it now. You got to put the work in, and that work manifests itself differently for everybody, which is why you got to ask all of these different questions.
And I like and agree entirely with Jordan's notion that perhaps you could even become one of the members of the Eternal Force fighting the forces of evil and chaos and destruction and attempting to help lessen the burdens that are unnecessary of others, and that that might be the higher purpose of all of the human race.
Yeah, I came up with like a formulation in my when I was coming out of my nihilism, let's say, that said, like, I had this like notion in my head that the human race was like a virus or whatever, like something hindering the cell. And you know, I was just like reading random stuff about biology, like watching some TED Eds and some like PBS videos, stuff like that, and I came up with, like, you know, what if we decided that we didn't have to be, you know, a virus or a sickness anymore, and we decided to become enzymes? I think we have the ability to do that. I think we can, you know, break down this chaotic material world a little bit better than we are currently, and I think we can help each other out a lot better than we are currently, rather than just, you know, like a virus spread itself across the planet like the Homo sapien race did.
And I think he also talks about, you know, you have emotions and then you have motivational states like hunger, thirst, and pain. And you can have a disagreement of opinion and sort of approach to problems, but if you don't have the emotional regulation to accept the fact that someone has a different opinion from you and that you still need to work together, like, you're just not ready to enter the arena yet, because you can't make it harder for people that want to make it easier for people, because that defeats the whole point.
Yeah, I think that reminds me a lot of, you know, the joke that's older than time, you know, a priest, a rabbi, an atheist walk into a bar. There's no punchline to that anymore because they're all at each other's throats. So, like, let's just bring that joke back. Like, the comedians are being silenced and they're the ones that need to save us. Like, we can't even tell that joke anymore because it doesn't even make sense. Priests and the rabbis and atheists are keeping to themselves. They don't go to the same bar.
We don't have bars anymore. We're in a pandemic.
Yeah, that's another problem. Talking about viruses.
Do you all want to talk about the overture?
Sure, but let me share with you my priest and rabbi joke, though. Sure. So a priest and a rabbit walk into a blood clinic, and the priest says, "I think I'm type A," and the rabbit says, "I think I'm a type O."
I don't get it.
Because it's a priest and a rabbit instead of a priest and a rabbi. So yeah. The rabbit says, I think I'm a typo.
Oh. All right.
Good job.
There was one thing I wanted to mention before we move on to the overture. And I think it's that this second chapter kind of is a roadmap for somebody who feels like they have no sense of meaning and nothing to do with their life. He's quite clearly saying that it's the new experiences that you take in life that will expose you to meaning, and that you have to start somewhere. Start at the beginning, work your way up to the master.
Yeah. Start as the fool, then become the master.
And whatever you do, do not outshine the master while you're at it.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, denigrating institutions. If you try to outshine the master, then you're saying, well, I'm better than the institution, so take that. that's a dangerous mindset to get into. I think that's precisely the mindset that destroyed Friedrich Nietzsche's mind.
Jordan quotes that in chapter one. Arrogance bars the path to learning. And it's almost like he left little other rules in these bigger sets. You know, I could see that being a rule on its own.
Yeah. It's not necessarily like a rule, but definitely a virtue, I would say. Something to keep in mind.
Almost like a feature of the rule or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's an intrinsic relationship between a lot of the sentiments he's expressing in the rule. Well, thoughts on the overture?
Well, my first thought is the one thing that he was doing other than writing this book and going through hell was rereading all the Harry Potter books. Because I don't know about you, but I lost track of how many Harry Potter references I found in this book.
It was beyond reference. It was analysis, and it was really cool and interesting because, of course, alchemy, sign me up to start talking about it. But then to take this thing that, you know, I read all the books before all the movies came out, and I watched all the movies, and I love Harry Potter. It was a great fantasy world. And to have that layer of meaning added to it through the dissection and analysis of these deeper themes, and then to wonder, you know, like just how much of a clue the author had as she was writing these books about that, because through his lens, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, after reading what he had gone through, it was, I felt fortunate to even be reading his second book, because, you know, here he was guided into this like hellish addiction by, you know, medical doctors, people that he trusted. He took, you know, the pills that they recommended, and then realized, oh my goodness, I'm like stuck on this ride. Can't get off. So it must have been really hard for him to get through that. And I kind of can relate to that.
Well, so I was sharing it with my coworker this week, and it's like you start describing the story that he has experienced over the past 5 years. And you make the first point, and the coworker's like, oh, wow, that's terrible. And you're like, and then this happened. He's like, wow, what an awful few years he's at. I'm like, no, we're still in the third month of the first year of a 5-year journey. And then this happened. and then that happened, and then this happened, and the guy's like, what on earth is going on?
And this isn't just an isolated incident. Like, he's been dealing with problems his whole life, like autoimmune issues for himself and his daughter, who's had like ankle replacements in childhood. Like, I couldn't even imagine going through the things that Jordan has. Like, we talk about forming a relationship with chaos. This guy's seen some chaos.
He's got a timeshare.
Yeah.
Right, but at the same time, he has zigzagged his way through this, like he says any person, any hero would do. And because I think he has these aims and goals, he's been able to keep a trajectory that's, I guess, a positive trajectory for the future.
Mm-hmm. I think that's like a genuine superpower. Like, I don't know how he did it. Like, he's got all these books that kind of explain it, but at the same time, I don't understand how it didn't break the guy. I mean, like, we don't even have time to list off all of the things that happened in the time where he was writing this book. And he was writing a book. So part of me thought that, like, you know, like the act of the drive for like the writing of the book, that was like a big part of probably what kept him going through it. Like, not just the, I have this thing I need to do, is just, I got something to do that isn't lying around and feeling sorry for myself. So I have a slight escape from that complete inside my head, just drowning out everything. So I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure you guys all listen to the podcast. If anyone hasn't in the audience listening, listen to, on, I think it was on his daughter's podcast where they talked about some of it. And it's just like the akathisia and the insomnia. And it's just like, I think we've all had at least one night where it was like, this is the worst night of my life. It's like, now imagine that for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Like,
yeah.
And to produce this beautiful gem.
Like, I have a history of like some pretty bad medical problems too, with my IBS, and like, I didn't know what was going on for the longest time. And really, it was Jordan Peterson and Michaela and a lot of guys on the Joe Rogan podcast coming up too that helped me to learn about how to fix myself. But at the back of my head, like, the only thing was like, I'm absolutely miserable. And then there's Michaela Peterson, whose conditions are clearly 100 times worse than mine. And I'm just sitting here feeling sorry for myself. Come on, I can do better than that. So, like, part of, like, getting out of the chaos was having someone to compare myself to. But I don't know what Jordan Peterson could have done. Like, I guess he was reading the Gulag Archipelago, so there's always someone in like a worse situation than you that you can derive some wisdom from.
And I think it's kind of like the hero who falls or gets bucked off the horse but gets back on. I think I think he tries to search for and point to the hero within himself, and that gives him the, I guess, strength to just try again.
I think so. The nihilist in me can conceive of the fact that there's millions of people waking up in the morning and looking in the mirror and quoting affirmational statements to themselves to encourage themselves. And the nihilist in me says, well, how stupid and pointless are we, right? Like, we're just these tiny little ants in this little rail system that some dioramist has made. And it's like, we're all just doing the thing. And then, you know, the part of me that's positive and optimistic thinks that's so cool and inspiring that we can all, you know, use these tools and be better and happy for each other. And I think we need to be able to relate to people in our greatness and in our suffering and in our low points, because if you think that you're the only person that's experiencing what you're experiencing, it's a lot easier to feel like there's nothing to be done about it. And I don't know if you guys caught the statistic, but what was it? I think 25% of millennials have no acquaintances, and 22% of millennials have no friends. And this is from the second chapter, the study from 2019 by YouGov. And it's like, holy cow, like, I have very few friends and acquaintances. My wife and I, especially in this pandemic, have been struggling with this problem of, you know, not having good, close relationships and consistent plans. Like you hear about men going on fishing trips. Well, it's like, we're men, and I haven't been on a fishing trip with my men friends. So what am I doing wrong? But to find out that 25% of us haven't been socially integrated well enough to establish consistent long-term relationships. It's like, oh, thank goodness, I'm not uniquely broken.
Yeah, but like the fact that we're not uniquely broken raises a big problem that we're all ununiquely broken.
But it's like we can unite under that banner, and we can do our best to have the desire to improve upon ourselves and know that we can be positioned as the experts of our experience, and we can share with others who have similar experience and can relate to us that, hey, read The Sandman, because it's great, and it's good to know that there are great things that you can consume and hallucinate about that aren't destructive to your psyche,
and connect, hey, over with other people.
Yeah, find your tribe, relate to them, share what helped you, and hopefully they have something of value as well. Listen with intent.
Yeah, find a DJ on YouTube and then join their Discord server and start a book club with them.
And I think there's something important too about cultivating a perspective that being born a human is a great gift in this universe.
Oh, there's one other mythological thing where he was talking about, like, the rebus, the image of the alchemist on the second chapter. And it's like, it's a representation of the fully integrated human. It's got one masculine head, one feminine head, and it represents chaos and order fully integrated together. And it's standing atop a dragon, or it's standing atop like the golden snitch guarded by a dragon. And like that symbol right there is found in pretty much all of our favorite myths, from, you know, Marduk to Odin, Beowulf, Pinocchio, Harry Potter, The Hobbit, The Avengers, Perseus versus Medusa, St. George, St. Patrick, St. Michael, and Jesus Christ himself. Many, many more.
Like Tarzan.
Yeah, I just wrote down the ones that Jordan listed off specifically. Yeah, there's just so much to be drawn from the integration of chaos and order and finding that middle ground. And when Jordan Peterson, like, just says, hey, you know, one book's white, one book's black, that says a lot more than what he's actually saying. So I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next two rules.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Don't be hiding unwanted things in the fog.
For sure. And if you're new around here and like what you heard, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel or our podcast platforms through anchor.fm. We got a website, bookwave.club. And may the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.
Have a great day.